Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Glasses Manifesto.
You have never met Klausner. He's never talked to you, right?
No, he's tried to get up here.
To write a book about your life.
Yeah. Well, he says he has enough information. The last letter I got from him says the book is complete. That's it. And, you know, I wish the guy luck because the only positive thing is the victims will make money, you know.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, a true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story, if not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Bill and Jack in Conversation, Bonus Episode 3, Letters with Berkowitz, Part 2. What is the reason for probing the murders?
My ethical impulses told me that understanding what, not only what he did, not just rehashing bloody and gory details, but probing his brain about the motivations was my only legitimate reason for spending this time and making an effort to inform the public below the surface.
It's also about keeping things in context, right? I mean, we're not talking about this guy's life because we're interested in him, separated from the pain that he's caused these people. If I think it keeps people aware of the reality of who and what we're talking about. That when he is, you know, like in your interviews, do so well, is that when you're talking about things that he's going through personally and emotionally as an individual, you're constantly reminded that this is not just a person for us to wildly empathize with, that this all is taking place in the context of like an inky black evil that robbed many people of their lives and countless others of every variety of happiness and enjoyment on this planet. Impossible to measure.
Right, right. And that's, you know, the crippled for life, psychologically scarred for life survivors, as well as those who died with bullets in their brains that
Absolutely.
He put there.
Absolutely.
In this letter, he also included a story by Klausner, the author of this very well researched but actually not accurately marketed book.
Well, and I think it's interesting to note that the stuff that Berkowitz seems to take of offense and objection to is not stuff that Klausner made up. It's stuff that Berkowitz made up about being led to scenes by voices and all this kind of stuff. It's not like Klausner invented this stuff that he's taking objection to. He's taking it from Berkowitz himself, from those police interviews, from the things, the early things he told the doctors initially, right? The competency hearings and this kind of thing.
Right, yeah.
So interesting that he would be so objecting so fiercely to this. And it also looks like he's got some handwritten notes here.
Oh, yeah. Not true. Not true. Misleading half-truth. Not true.
Can you walk us through some of these things that Berkowitz has indicated as being not true?
And this is...
in the Klausner book.
Right. And this is... It looks like Klausner is giving a review of his own book to try to sell it.
That's interesting.
Son of Sam, based on the authorized transcription of the tapes, official documents, and diaries of David Berkowitz.
No, these are different, just so it's clear to people who are listening, this is different tapes than your tapes.
Completely different.
Now, he's talking about police tapes?
He's talking about police and prosecutor-authorized psychiatric interviews that somehow he gained access to through the police force in New York City.
So this would have been tapes that were originated in fall of 77 and in 78.
Right.
Okay.
When Berkowitz was at Rikers Island awaiting a trial that never happened.
And singing a much different tune.
Right.
Than in your tapes. Okay. Yeah.
The inside story, aren't they all, you know, revealed for the first time, isn't it always? David Berkowitz committed his first act of wanton violence on Christmas Eve, 1975. He attacked two females, a 13-year-old girl and a middle-aged woman, with a hunting knife that had a 4.5-inch blade. The woman never filed a complaint with the New York City Police Department. Berkowitz, who would have known, says, not true.
But he doesn't really specify what in that paragraph is right. Not true.
Right.
Just because some of that we know is true.
Right. And both only one of those attacks occurred on Christmas Eve, though. Mm. There was only one woman that he. There was
Michelle
another
Foreman.
One. Yeah.
Yeah. Brutal.
Yeah.
Unbelievably brutal attack. Yeah.
And the knife is a tough way. You got to get it up close and personal with someone.
I was gonna say. Common for these guys to start with knives, find out they are terribly hard to use, and you're very close, and it's just a gross experience.
Right. That's a human being.
Yeah, you can't. Right, exactly. Yeah. You can't separate yourself from it because you're right there.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not a target. I think
it doesn't happen quickly. They're fighting and crying and screaming.
Yeah. Unless you're some guy like OJ who really wanted to kill his ex-wife and her boyfriend for a reason. I think he really wanted to feel the blood of those two victims. It's a different kind of crime altogether.
Sure.
That was a crime of passion. From that point, David Berkowitz became Son of Sam, the demon-haunted. It was Son of Sam came much later, so that's clearly wrong. 44 caliber killer. Within the next 2 years, David fired his weapon at 32 human targets. He says, not true.
32?
No, I don't know where that number came from.
Number that we know of is 13.
13.
Okay.
Yeah. He killed 6 and wounded 7 in 8 known attacks. Most of the victims were women, young and pretty, good students from loving families. There were other crimes, too. Vicious and destructive that have never before been revealed.
What is he making
not true?
Not true, as denoted by David Berkowitz. What is Klausner referring to there? Do you think he's referring to the letters written to Carr or the Molotov cocktails?
He must be alluding to the arsons.
Okay. Okay.
But no, there were no other crimes committed by.
And that would be the 1,400 approximate arsons that are detailed in a journal that confiscated by the police at the time of his arrest, from 1974 to 1975, in which Berkowitz details with great detail 1,400 approximate incidences of arson supposedly perpetrated by him. During that time period.
Correct.
Right. Okay.
Correct. He wanted a record for his merit badge or something. Klausner says compiled from more than 300 secret tape recordings of David Berkowitz conversations. And Berkowitz says that's not true. With psychiatrists, police, attorneys, plus his own never before revealed handwritten notes and diaries, this is a chilling story of a psychotic killer, and he says not true. with psychotic killer.
He's specific about that because he's very concerned about not being labeled crazy. Right. Okay. Because he's underlined in ink psychotic, so we know that the not true in that margin is about that specifically.
Right. That he was lucid and in control and had full memory of every killing. A psycho would be, in his mind at that point, someone schizophrenic and out of control and, was, I don't know what I did. I woke
not
up,
understanding.
My life was in my hand and she was dead. It tells of his boyhood, his hopes, his fears, his deepening despair, the demons who demanded that he kill for them, which we know now is bullshit. His initial horror at his deeds, his increasing sense of infallibility. That's arguable, especially the initial horror. I mean, he stopped and had a hamburger after, Beyond that, the narrative contains the stories of 300 individual policemen who were trying to track him down in a frantic race against time. Newspapers that unconsciously used Son of Sam to boost circulation. That wasn't unconscious at all. That was calculated.
Also, this is the only paragraph that doesn't have a not true on it. And I do have to say, it really speaks to what you were mentioning earlier about how he was in with the police department, because the amount of detail in the Klausner book about the officers on the Omega Task Force is unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's very, very dense. I mean, they are very well painted in terms of detail. You know exactly who they are. They even have like short biographies going back, like from before they were involved.
Yeah,
no, this is incredibly detailed.
Yeah, and also given the incredible incompetence of the police in cracking that case, it gives the police the benefit of the doubt everywhere he possibly can. I mean, this guy was in tight with the.
Well, and to their defense, this is a really one hardest kind of crimes to solve because there's no connectivity.
Except that there were connections all over the place that they ignored and didn't follow up on. And part of the problem was that they set up a Son of Sam bureaucracy, and we all know what bureaucracies are like, with all these different police agencies, each one wanting the credit and not passing on, you know, vital information
to
others who could have pieced it together.
As we know from the Bundy case, the 70s are not known for their interconnectivity in terms of jurisdictional overlap.
Yep. Yeah, and even though they had this task force, there was really nobody in charge. It was Keystone Cops.
Yeah.
Running
around in 365 square miles filled with, you know, probably about 10 million people. And as it turns out, the perpetrator is not even in those 365 square miles.
Right.
Just north.
Right. Yeah. And they were tipped off that he was just north, and they discounted it numerous times.
Well, this is what happens time and time again, right? Is when the police, it's that catch-22 of that the police need help from the public. They need the calls to come in. They need some information to flow. But once you open that gate, you can't control how much information flows in. So what so often happens, and certainly what happened here, is that so much information flows in that now you have a new problem.
No.
And that problem is wading through, because we know that Sam Carr did approach the police and say, you know, there's a problem with David Berkowitz. And I believe that he even contacted the Omega Task Force directly. But he just becomes another one of these calls that come in. And so unless there becomes like a cross-hatching, it just kind of, you know, it's a lone call. It's very difficult.
Right.
I mean, I understand exactly what you're saying, but it's a monumental task that they were.
Yeah. But it was complicated by the police themselves.
Right. Because it was 75 detectives and 225 police officers, I believe, at the height.
Sounds.
Something like that.
Sounds yeah. right. Including to the police officers who wrote the ticket, which ultimately led to his arrest, who said that they didn't remember writing a ticket that night.
Oh my God, I forgot about that. That's
And the murder took place what, 45 minutes later, within walking distance.
Right. They ran the search for the tickets and came up with nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until the eyewitness of the woman, the older woman who was walking her dog, that they went back and looked at it again and came up with 5 tickets. And he was, Berkowitz was on that list. And of course, from out of the area, which makes him a prime suspect of what are you doing here in the middle of the night? You know, you don't live anywhere near here. Yeah, amazing confluence of events that brought about his arrest. Take us into this final paragraph here of this.
The one labeled not true, underlined. The author has interviewed everyone connected with the case.
Oh, so this not true is in reference to himself.
Yeah, he didn't interview Berkowitz.
Got it.
Surviving victims and their families, which he did do, you know, a thorough job of there, it seemed. The families of those killed, politicians and police, da-da-da-da-da, detectives, psychiatrists, the usual suspects, in other words. This compelling story of 8 million New Yorkers threatened by an unknown killer is destined to make publishing history. I don't know about that. Misleading half-truth. All monies earned by this book that are payable to David Berkowitz are being paid to the court for the compensation of his victims.
So do you know what he means when he says misleading half-truth in reference to that paragraph?
I don't know that any of the money was ever earmarked payable to David Berkowitz. You know, there's no reason that it would be because Berkowitz never signed a contract with this guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And Lawrence D. Klausner has published 2 novels and is working on a third. 2 of his books will be made into full-length movies, and I have no idea, but Berkowitz labeled that not true.
So something in there he was objecting to.
Yeah.
He's not real specific about... Yeah. He's specific in some of the cases,
yeah,
but not all.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, and clearly, at this point, he just, for whatever reason,
he's upset about this book. Yeah. Yeah, right. That's clear.
Yeah.
He makes that very clear.
Yeah.
Okay, so what's the next letter then that you've received?
September 4th. Once again, typewritten to me at my home. Today I received your letter of 8380. Yes, come on over for a visit and make all the arrangements that are required. But please, no camera. Glassman's book sounds like a pulp-style detective magazine from the way you've described it. However, I feel no threat from it because I don't believe it will sell. It was terrible.
Now, I've not read Glassman's book, but tell us who Craig Glassman is.
Craig Glassman was the sheriff's deputy from another jurisdiction who unwittingly lived right beneath the Son of Sam for several months and did not become sufficiently, it seems, suspicious, even though Berkowitz at one point started a fire in front of his door and the hallway and left letters, you know, very threatening, kind of weird letters that...
Because according to Berkowitz, Glassman liked to blast his TV at night.
Right. Would come home late at night and blast his TV, and that can be as bad as dogs barking.
Right, and in this case, it nearly was. You know, it's been reported different ways, but I wanted to mention that in some ways I've heard it reported was that Glassman was a volunteer with the sheriff's department. So I think it's somewhat unclear whether or not he was...
I think he was a first responder. I think,
there you go.
You know, like firefighter or medic with one of the suburban agencies outside New York City.
So not on the main full-time staff.
And he was a volunteer deputy sheriff or part-time anyway. But he had a permit to carry a gun.
Right, which is difficult in New York City.
Right. Even if you are a first responder.
Okay.
And not a police officer. So yeah, as for the court-related matters, my goodness, Johnson is really throwing up some flack. Johnson must be one of the attorneys. I can't remember who it was. Probably one of the publishing attorneys. It's one hell of a battle. McGraw-Hill seems to be basically unconcerned and is acting nonchalant. Of course, they haven't met my new attorney yet. I'll find tomorrow if he'll take my case. You probably don't know what this means, but Johnson and Rubenstein have filed an action in court. The purpose is to institute a committee, the most extreme action they could take, in parentheses. Although Rubenstein will tell you that it is just to manage my property, it is actually a small body of rulers who will completely control my life. I think this must be the guardians ad litem that are appointed to oversee the estates of people who are ruled incompetent. And there's a letter in here which may answer that. Yeah, this is Rubenstein.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, right. These are the guardians ad litem for his estate.
But what is...
Court-appointed.
What property, what estate would someone like Berkowitz have?
Well, he had the collection of porn magazines.
Confiscated at his arrest.
Yeah, I mean, he still
several
had...
Several firearms.
Yeah, firearms. Very little furniture. Had a car. The Ford Galaxy that he drove around in.
Not a lot of possessions.
Not a lot. And I think that as a veteran, he may have been receiving some sort of minor disability thing that I'm not sure what was. I remember, I never talked to him about this, but there was one newspaper story, which I can't verify the accuracy of, but it was one of these alarmist things. Son of Sam to receive veterans' pensions, you know.
So mostly they're probably handling the public aspect of his life, which is vastly large in contrast to the private aspect of his life, which is very small.
Right. But at that point, potentially, if the, let's say, the Son of Sam law had been totally overturned, he would have been in line to receive a hell of a lot of money from these book and movie projects.
Right,
and, of course, you would want to be Mr. Rubenstein or someone else who was in position to take a portion of that as legal fees.
Sure.
And allocate it as you saw fit.
Right.
Because Berkowitz was prevented from doing that by the courts.
Okay.
So yeah, this is potentially, I mean, he could have wound up conceivably a multimillionaire sitting in prison.
Right.
Because of his crimes. To his credit, I guess, you know, he
backed this law.
Yeah. 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 Although Rubenstein will tell you that it is just to manage my property, it is actually a small body of rulers who will completely control my life. In a sense, that's true. I will be in complete subjugation to Doris Johnson and her cohorts. On Monday, September 8th, the presiding justice will decide whether or not to allow me to go downstate. I'm pretty nervous about this because there is no law that says he must honor Judge Conable's order. Judge Conable was the Wyoming County court judge at that point, who became a congressman, Barbara Conable. The order can be denied. The letter would, of course, forever end my chance at ending this endless madness. When you come over, please bring the two booklets concerning the Crime Victims Compensation Board and the board's appeal. What that would be one of them.
Okay.
These are the two booklets bound by yellow covers. I need much of the information that is contained in them, and you can make photocopies of the booklets for yourself.
Now, this is, he's referencing a book that was put together in order to aid the passing of the Son of Sam law that we went over in detail in another bonus episode.
Correct. Correct. These are core documents, New York State Supreme Court, instructions concerning certain publishing agreements, Crime Victims Compensation Board.
He wants you to bring this in to him so he can look at it.
Right.
Okay.
I probably wasn't allowed to bring that in because, as I mentioned, they regulate the material.
Of course.
You can play with it. When you come over, please bring the two booklets concerning the Crime Victims Compensation Board and the board's appeal. Okay. Arrange the visit for any time that is convenient to you, but after September 7th. Yours, David Berkowitz, signed in ink.
So at this point, he's almost kind of writing to you as a friend, because some of this stuff has nothing to do with the work that you guys are doing together.
Right, right. He is, enlisting me in his efforts to carry his complaints about the Klausner book, which he found unfounded and too exploitive.
Sure.
And the movie. And
right.
Also to do whatever I could to advance the rights of the prisoners and guards whose families suffered as a result of the Attica 1971 prison riot.
Now, is this the last piece of correspondence that you received from?
There is one, at least one more. Okay. Two more. Okay.
This one's also from September.
Yeah. This is from September. This is
also the smallest.
Yeah, and yeah, this is on one line sheet, typewritten over.
A half sheet of paper.
Yeah, and this relates to another document that we looked at from the prison psychologist who had been meeting with him regarding his displeasure over a woman with whom he had corresponded voluminously, who turned his letters over to an AP reporter.
This is D Channel?
This is D Channel.
Okay.
Channel.
Can you tell us a little bit about her?
She is a person who apparently took a great deal of interest in famous and infamous crime figures and began writing to me. I received dozens. At one point, I was getting several letters a month from her about the most detailed issues, including the Attica riot, prisoners' rights, and her friendship with David Berkowitz. And she obviously was not just writing to me. She turned over his letters to an Associated Press reporter who used them for a story about Berkowitz that Berkowitz did not authorize and was most unsettled by.
So he's voicing his outrage here about that. Okay.
And he's actually, at this point, he's turning against me as a member of the press because my newspaper,
because he's
wasn't
upset
my,
about an unrelated article. Okay.
Right. But my newspaper carried that AP story. And that tipped him over.
So that's how he relates it to you. It wasn't something that you wrote. It was something that your paper picked up.
Right.
Okay.
Had nothing to do with me, but it,
Sure.
Okay. Addressed to me at home, September 21st, 1980. Dear Jack, I managed to get hold of the recent article that appeared in the September 21st edition of the DNC. So this is the same day. He's writing me immediately. Actually, I had nothing to do with this, at least not directly, in parentheses. D Channel. the lady we just referred, provided Rick Pinciak with many of my letters. He's the AP reporter. I did write to Pinciak occasionally, okay, but I broke off contact because he wanted too much. My letters to him were much too trivial to be of any value. But Dee's were not. And she turned over her and his personal correspondence to this guy. The September 21st article disgusted me, and it taught me just how nonsensical and silly all this is becoming. Surely this thing must have been the dumbest one yet, and may it be the last. Since your paper printed that foolish story, I think it best that I don't work with the DNC any longer. Besides, I'm tired of all this. It's also time that this boring and trivial publicity ends permanently. Sincerely, signed, David B.
It's a different way of signing than the previous.
The first time he just used his last initial, although he rewrote his full name and with a typewriter, David Berkowitz. P.S. I never gave permission for D Channel to give Pinciak my letters. She did the same with you. And yes, she did send me letters.
Can you tell us what about this article he's so upset about? Why he's so upset?
He had no control over it. It was totally unauthorized.
No control.
And it was a lot of personal stuff, kind of commentary about other things. And but it was essentially...
Because to be fair, he's shared personal information about his life with different sources. So I really feel like you hit it on the head when you say that he had no control, because the pattern that I see in this stuff is that, you know, when he, you know, even if the person agrees, like, you know, Abrahamson is like, you know, a psychiatrist, so he's interested in what David's interested in for the purpose of that book, which is to create a profile that can be used to prevent further actions and crimes like this. You know, and your interest in mental health and the prison system and, you know, the Victim Compensations Board, like, even if you agree, these things have, like, a clear purpose. And he really gets upset when something comes out where he's not involved in the purpose defining of that project, such as Klausner.
Right.
Right.
Also, what she did was a breach of personal trust.
Because he was writing to her for what reason? Just as a personal friend?
Right. It is a person to, you know, she was obviously had educated herself about the prison system, the Attica riots. She would get him any background information that he asked her to get, you know.
But also, to keep it in context, pretty wild for a person who took away other people's children to be complaining about his personal freedoms in a letter being infringed on.
Right. But these guys are always the ultimate victim.
Right. We see that kind of here. Yeah. Like, oh, look at me and my situation when the the other people that, you know, what he's done, there's no limit to the bottom of that pit.
Right. It reminds me a lot of certain politicians, one in particular, who is always the victim. No matter what horrible fuck up or what horrible, you know, crime they have committed against the country or, you know.
Right, countless
anybody.
People.
Yeah. Okay, grab them by the what?
So is this the final piece of correspondence, or we have one more from December?
No, it looks like we have one more here. At some point, he sent me a pamphlet, David Berkowitz, Son of God.
Tell us this, describe this pamphlet for us.
This would be after he, you know, not only had turned from the darkness and the demons, but was recruited into one of the same Christian groups that the well-known evangelist Mark David Chapman.
Oh, right.
Was
so I just want to say this pamphlet that Jack's holding is a professionally printed pamphlet with different colors printed in there of type and a photograph of David with a pretty professional looking photograph with a mustache and some pretty stylish hair and his signature printed above, and it looks like it comes out of a P.O. box from Hearst, Texas.
This guy, Don Dickerman, is a minister who cruises the prisons and does his prison. I was on a couple of panels with him, actually.
Oh, okay.
In New York City when they did a
And what year do you think-ish this is, this pamphlet?
This would have been... I was training for a marathon that year. This would have been 1991.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
And what is the purpose of this pamphlet as you see it?
This is his personal testament as a Christian and the evils of people who turn from God and leave themselves open to be manipulated by satanic influence.
So is this kind of saying, if I can be saved, anyone can be saved, sort of thing?
Exactly.
Okay, can you read us a few of the quotes on the front page there?
My parents would break down and cry because they saw that I was such a tormented person. I craved the darkness when I was a child. I roamed the darkened streets like an alley cat, and I wasn't yet a teenager. I could barely hang on to my sanity. David Berkowitz.
So is this him getting back on the page of the devil made me do it sort of stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. This, no doubt. And it's interspersed with commentary by the Reverend Dickerman, who also, I think Dickerman kind of made his bones when he's a Texan, and one of Manson's gang there, the cowboy guy.
Tex.
Yeah, Tex. Yeah, I think it is Tex.
Well, his nickname. Right, yeah.
Yeah. Agreed to be interviewed by, was, of course, like all of these guys. They get to prison, they're born again, all the way back to diapers. And,
sure.
And Jesus has washed the slate clean.
But in David's case, it kind of goes back and forth, it seems like.
Yeah. And he had even though he was raised in this Jewish household, he dabbled in the whole evangelical Christian thing when he was in the army in Kentucky. And
yep, Fort
this
Knox.
Was like a charismatic sort of cult, you know, mega church. So, yeah. Thoughts of suicide plagued me continually. I was so depressed and haunted that I would also spend time sitting on the window ledge of my bedroom with my legs dangling over the side. My parents would yell at me to get in, but I seldom listened to them. I would feel such an urge to push myself out the window that my body would tremble violently, and we lived on the sixth floor. So wild and crazy, mixed up that I could barely hang on to my sanity. Felt as if I were being pulled along by a powerful force.
Do you think this is content from an interview that this pastor did with?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he correspondence of some kind,
right. This would have been, you know, late in the 80s or the 90s after he had turned back to God.
Gotcha. Well, take us into this final letter. Is this the final piece of correspondence that you received from David Berkowitz?
This appears to be the last one. David Berkowitz written to me at home on December 27th, 1980. R.E., Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Dear Jack, remember the McGraw-Hill book? Well, I've already secured an advance copy. A complete flop. The New York Times has refused to review it because it wasn't well written and it is sick. What McGraw-Hill did is what McGraw-Hill is doing now is aggressively pushing the book and distributing it to large chain bookstores. The reason for this is when the reviews come out, sales will probably freeze.
Now this again, this is David's review. This is Berkowitz reviewing the Klausner book, of which he had no input and control, and expressing his outrage
right
about this fact.
Over material that the author obtained by whatever means from police sources.
Sure.
You know, and I don't know how, but that's what journalists do, you know. You get
obtained legally. This right. book is very well researched, obtained yeah. legally. David's just upset that he was right. not involved in it.
Right.
Yeah.
A friend of mine has seen the book on the racks in many large bookstores. However, they aren't selling. The book was poorly written with many errors in fact. The book is really sick. All the violence is magnified greatly so that reading becomes nauseating. It has no literary quality and is very sensationalistic. He doesn't okay. miss a category there and
yeah,
putting
no.
it down.
And obviously, we've both read this book. This book is, like we said, is very well researched. But also, I have to say that is from the perspective of Berkowitz at his arrest, when he's hearing voices. The voices are leading him to the victims and also to the locations. But I didn't find it to be overly gruesome. These situations are incredibly gruesome.
Oh, absolutely.
These murders. Yeah. And I do not agree yeah. with this letter. Right. I do not think that they were sensationalized by Klausner right. in the least. Yeah. I mean, these are horrifically violent.
Yeah. Yeah, my one critique is that it was written like everybody who was going to read it lived in New York City and knew the layout of every street and every turn.
There's like directions in it.
Yeah, it's almost like a yeah. you know.
I noticed that.
A map guide.
Oh, I mean, I think you can follow yeah. the directions. It's like turn here, turn yeah. here. It's very interesting. Yeah. I don't know why he decided to do that. The one thing I really liked about it as a reader, I lived in New York City for a really long time. But even just as a reader that doesn't live in the city anymore, it makes it feel more real. And I think that's really important. That the myth, in some ways, it supports the mythology because it's based on the mythological telling that Berkowitz made to doctors and, you know, sort of like a pre-1979 version of the story for him. But it also makes you really realize and be able to visualize this is a person who left an apartment. And Klausner will describe the clothes that he was wearing and leaving the apartment and getting in his car and turning left here and turning right here. And so in the other way, it breaks down that mythology and says this is just a person who did not take care of his internal situation. And it resulted in the death and sadness of so many people, loss for so many people. So it was an interesting choice, but it's heavily detailed in terms of street names and traffic.
Yeah. he continues, Gallery Magazine, February 1981 issue, now at newsstands, has the excerpt as its main feature. It is odd, though. Klausner tries to treat the victims with dignity and portrays them in a saintly manner. Yet their story appears in a pornographic magazine.
Sure.
Prude, you know, he's
yes,
the all-time.
He's fairly, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, at least he wants to give off an impression of.
Yeah. And then he tells me, please get your copy of Gallery at your local newsstand. But I wouldn't recommend the book.
Oh, okay. I think that was clear.
Yours truly, David Berkowitz. He signed his full name again.
This time. Okay.
And that is the last that I have on hand.
Did you ever see him or correspond with him again after December of 1980?
I think it was shortly after that he was transferred downstate, and I haven't seen him since he...
And it was around that time that you met Mark David Chapman.
Well, it's...
The next year, I guess.
This was a couple of weeks after the John Lennon murder. Mm-hmm. And it was the following year that Chapman pleaded guilty, actually several months later. Chapman pleaded guilty, and I met him at Attica and began...
Working with him.
Began working with him, and because the books had already been written about Berkowitz,
right.
Even though I still have these interviews with material nobody else has ever got or published on tape anyway, or in a book. I just kind of moved on to the Chapman stuff. At the urging of a friend who was a counselor with, you know, hardcore murderers inside the prison. And
Harold
Steele. And who later we found out had some serious issues of his own. Mm. Died quite young. But...
So we have one more piece in front of it. What is this? This is something that David wrote and asked you to copy edit. Is that right?
You know, I'm going to have to... Yeah, this is something that Berkowitz and I kind of worked on together.
Okay.
We often laugh at how our ancestors used to attribute, quote, demon possession to various forms of mental illness and mental retardation.
Just for our younger listeners, that was a word that used to be acceptable and is no longer.
It was no longer.
Yeah.
Retardation does not exist. They had absolutely no understanding of the human mind, its breaking point, and the pressure exerted on it by the emotions of resentment, anger, hate, fear, worry, jealousy, etc. To these people of 300 years ago, the Salem, Massachusetts witchcraft trials era, anyone who demonstrated peculiar habits, strange behavior, or just plain lunacy was subsequently declared to be, quote, vexed with devils, unquote, and thus brutally tortured, imprisoned, and eventually slain. We laugh with humor and cry with anger at the obvious ignorance of these barbaric peasants, but have we really advanced much since then? In a way, we haven't. While we now know that most of these cases of alleged possession were really different and common forms of mental illness, we're still fond of declaring many violent and seemingly motiveless crimes as the works of, quote, demented madmen. This view of branding a criminal, quote, insane, unquote, because we cannot understand the motives for his crime, is as primitive as the ancient beliefs that people who sang to themselves were demon-possessed and people who did somersaults in pools of mud while wearing their Sunday best were the servants of Satan. The people of society cannot tolerate a case in which one of their own fold goes about killing the innocent. They cannot explain it, so they become angry. Society cannot understand a certain individual's actions, so they waste no time in labeling him, quote, criminally insane. However, by doing so, by refusing to investigate the evidence and even-handedly weighing it, they have done the ultimate harm to themselves. No, burying the problem or hiding it is not the answer. These problems usually reroute themselves around any obstacle that is placed in front of them, only to appear on the surface and in full view once again. Therefore, perhaps a study of this person's life and mind would be beneficial. Question mark. But society's lack of tolerance, parentheses, perhaps out of fear, on parentheses, and its lackadaisical attitude have caused them to turn inward to themselves. Thus, the one who motivelessly, not my word, I'm sure, strayed is then sent to one of those foreboding houses of Bedlam. These houses of Bedlam are often referred to as mental hospitals, state hospitals, or psychiatric centers. Well, these names are euphemisms, of course, but I won't argue this point now. The phrase, quote, mass murder, unquote, always sends chills up our spines as we attempt to contemplate its meaning. These ominous words, when they are combined together, no doubt, cause more fear and terror than could be adequately described. Oh, yes, the obvious meanings are a large mass of people who are murdered by one individual or murdered by a group of individuals working together for the same cause. The, quote, Zodiac killer, unquote, was a mass murderer. But so is Idi Amin. However, the members of this nation don't feel as threatened by fat, ugly Idi, who is the leader of Uganda, very powerful, evil man who supposedly boiled and ate children alive.
Okay.
However, the members of this nation don't feel as threatened by fat, ugly Idi Amin as they do by someone like Zodiac or the Boston Strangler. Perhaps the fear of the lone mass killer's randomness and the fact that he seems to prowl through everybody's quiet neighborhoods have filled them with such fear that they are blinded by this emotion and are thus unable to rationalize everything. Yes, fear could be a terrible emotion. So could anger. But so could intolerance. Therefore, what should society do with these multiple murderers? Should they execute them out of anger? Should society demand that these killers be imprisoned for not less than 2,000 years, nor more than 6,000 years? Or should they merely label those who slew the innocent as demented lunatics, refuse to tolerate the issues any longer, and thus toss them into a world of drugs and straitjackets? Well, in a sense, all the answers are acceptable, because society will have to choose one of them. Unfortunately, these are the only alternatives known to humankind. But will any of these choices be beneficial to society's members from educational or scientific points of view? Will there be anything learned with regard to what made a seemingly normal individual do what he did? Really, we do need some answers. We need them desperately and soon. Also, we mustn't treat the matter too lightly. Why? Because there have been an abundance of mass murderers at work in this nation in the last two decades, perhaps as many as five dozen. Some of the more notable ones are the Hillside Strangler, 15 victims, Zodiac, 6, possibly 25 victims, Boston Strangler, 13, John Gacy, 33 young boys, Richard Speck, 8, Son of Sam, 6, Edward Kemper III, 11, Juan Corona, 23, Charles Whitman, 14, Theodore Ted Bundy, 3, possibly 36, Michigan co-ed killer, 6, cut, torture, and bind killer, 6, and still uncaught.
That's BTK he's talking about.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, cut, torture, and, okay, yeah. Columbus, Georgia, rapist killer, 7. That was the one black guy out of the bunch. Okay, I'm blocking on his name now, yeah. Very unusual. And it was more than seven, and I'm still uncaught at that time. Houston, Texas, 28 young boys tortured and murdered. Yorkshire Ripper, 12 and uncaught. plus an innumerable host of others. Just recently, a former Vietnam veteran in New Mexico confessed to 6 senseless murders, and 2 were recently apprehended in California for the murders of at least 5 young girls.
Okay, so who wrote that?
Berkowitz.
Okay, and what was the purpose of that?
That was to serve as something of a preface to the book that I still intend to write, which will give a background for why it's important to probe deeper than the Klausner book, and maybe in a more reader-friendly style than the Professor Abrahamson's
sure.
work.
So this is interesting, this last paragraph, because this really speaks back to something that we were discussing earlier, is this want to see himself included in this list of famous killers. So he writes this, he includes himself kind of sneakily again, as his MO is, in the middle of this list. And a couple other things jumped out to me. One, what I thought was interesting, was that he mentioned the Boston Strangler, because he mentions in your interview that, you know, in your interview, he makes very clear a list of like movies that he took inspiration from. And I think identifying with the killer in whichever movie it is to differing degrees, right? But the Boston Strangler movie starring Tony Curtis, which is actually a really, really great movie.
Yeah, I saw that years ago. Yeah,
it's a really well done movie. It's really artistic, the editing and everything for the time.
Albert DiSalvo, right?
Yeah, right. And starring Tony Curtis, and it was a comeback film for Curtis. It was the first, and it was very well received, was the first movie that Berkowitz lists as being in that sort of lineage, which obviously leads up to Taxi Driver being the one he identifies with the most. I don't think... It's my personal opinion that I don't think he identified that much with Curtis. Curtis didn't do anything. With DeSalvo, with the Boston Strangler.
Right, because these were sexual.
Exactly, yeah. Precisely. There was sexual contact. They were assaults, of course, but there was physical contacts of that nature in those assaults, and I don't think that's something which sort of that he identifies with. It's interesting also that he mentions Whitman, because the movie that's as Taxi Driver is seen a month before the first murder, The Deadly Tower from 1975 starring Kurt Russell, he sees a month before the first stabbing.
Texas Tower, I think, yeah.
Right. December, about the Texas Tower, December 24th, Christmas Eve, 1975, when he attacks Michelle Forman, who thankfully lives. That movie about Whitman, I see as the first time that Berkowitz watched a movie where he started to identify with the killer as the subject of the film, because Whitman is a young man who is ex-military, has been in the military. There, another big one is that Whitman starts off with 2 stabbings, as Berkowitz does. One of both for Whitman end in fatalities, one of his wife and one of his mother, and then he puts together an arsenal. A stockpile, which Berkowitz was also compiling. He puts it into a military, like, footlocker type box. It's so big and it's so heavy that he has to go before he goes to the tower. He goes and rents a dolly to be able to carry it up. Now, the interesting thing that jumps out to me about that is that when Berkowitz is arrested on August 11th, 1977, one of the ways that they know that they, quote, got their man is they identify the car, right, because of the parking ticket. It's parked outside, and they look in the back seat, and there is the stockpile that he had taken out to Long Island to commit a mass murder a la Whitman at the beach that didn't end up taking place because it starts to rain.
It starts to rain, yeah.
Right. So they see, but it's, again, it's not a big wooden footlocker, but it is an army or a military issued duffel bag full of a stockpile. And they see that that weapon sticking out of the end of the bag, and then they go into the car and they find, you know, a letter and stuff. And so some similarities, you know, between these characters. And I think where he sort of, this is again my opinion, I think where he gets off the boat, so to speak, with Whitman is same as he gets off the boat with DeSalvo, is that Whitman was married. He had an actual physical relationship with a woman. And also, I think that this is a weird one, too, because I think that Berkowitz kind of liked to present himself as a clean-cut kind of type. You know, he wasn't a hippie. You know, he was pro the war in Vietnam and wanted to be involved in it. And I think that was another way that he rejected his peer group in Co-op City. Is I think that we're starting to be like long-haired, smoking pot, and you know he sort of rejected that and was very like, you know, patriotic, as he put it, gung ho with a death wish and wanted to go to Vietnam. Whereas Whitman was pretty clean cut, at least in the film, that he's shown as being very clean cut. And I think when you see Robert De Niro's portrayal of what they said later was probably based on Arthur Brenham. In Taxi Driver, I think it's just all the lights line up for Berkowitz, where it's just green, 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 where he sees this guy that's this loner. It takes place in New York City, which he obviously is from and has a huge emotional relationship with. And it just all kind of lines up, and he buys the .44, which, of course, is mentioned over and over in the movie. So, interesting kind of timeline. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Here, and you can sort of see little evidences of it, but it's pretty clearly outlined in your interview.
Yeah, and you know his repeatedly going over the fact that he's against a movie being made about him because it will prompt another lunatic like him, just like the other movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it creates a very strange
his reference point, yeah.
Yeah, the snake biting its tail. This Ouroboros type of situation where he is inspired by movies about killers. He becomes a killer. Movies are made about him, and he's concerned with breaking this chain. But as we've said many times, it's not that simple either. He's also getting to play Puppet Master again. He's also getting to be, you know, he's getting to be in control. He's getting to do some cleanup as he sees it on his public image. It's very wrapped up and complicated.
Yep.
Well, thank you for sharing all this stuff with us, Jack. This is great.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistants by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt, Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.